Today's episode of The History of Food is brought to you by coffee. Where would we be without coffee? I, like so many of us around the world, love and depend on this black and bitter drink. I start just about every day with a cup, and I always have some before recording this podcast. That's right, if you have anything good to say about my mood and demeanor as a host over these past couple years, you can thank coffee. But coffee does more than just get us out of bed and give us a boost needed to begin our day. It fundamentally changed society and history. We're going to see today how when Europeans discovered coffee, they had discovered the fuel which would drive revolutions in science, philosophy, government, literature, and most of all, commerce. The world of global finance, of consumer capitalism, that world so dominated by business and profit-seeking that we know so well today, was just now coming into being in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it was partially driven by coffee. Today, coffee plants occupy 27 million acres of farmland, and it's one of the most valuable commodities on the global market. As famed food writer Michael Pollan puts it, not bad for a shrub that is neither edible nor particularly beautiful or easy to grow. Coffee owes its global ascendancy to an accident of evolution. Coffee plants inject a chemical compound into their beans in order to protect themselves from bugs and parasites. That compound happens to alter human consciousness in ways that we like, making us more energetic and productive. I'm talking, of course, about caffeine, which 80% of all humans consume today, making it by far the most popular psychoactive drug on the planet. But historically speaking, this is a relatively new phenomenon. Coffee was mostly unknown in Europe until 400 years ago. And while untold hunter-gatherers in Africa over the eons have probably chewed on wild coffee beans, the plant was not officially discovered by agrarian societies until the 9th century AD. There are many tales concerning the discovery of coffee. Legend has it, it was a goat herd who first noticed coffee in a corner of Ethiopia. The story goes that he noticed his animals would nibble on its bright red berries and then get frisky and energetic and not sleep all night. Supposedly, the goat herd then gave some of the beans to his local imam, who figured out how to dry, grind, and boil them in water to make a hot drink. Another story takes place in the desert city in Yemen called Mocha. Yes, really, Mocha. Supposedly, a man was outcast and condemned to starve to death in the desert, but he stumbled upon a wild coffee tree. The kick from its berries gave him the strength he needed to return to the city, where his survival was taken to mean that God had intentionally spared him in order to deliver the knowledge of coffee to the city. These are legends, but they contain some truth. Coffee really did first originate in Ethiopia. Also, preparing coffee as a drink and its widespread popularity did first happen in Yemen in the mid-1400s, where Muslim scholars discovered how to make it and used the drink to stay awake all night during religious ceremonies. With alcoholic drinks prohibited in an Islamic territory, coffee spread quickly as an alternative, pleasurable, social beverage, a drink that friends could meet and chat over. Some imams and scholars argued that coffee was still intoxicating and should thus be subject to the same religious prohibitions as alcohol. A few powerful religious leaders even made some laws and tried to ban coffee a couple times, but they were either unsuccessful or had to quickly reverse course when it became clear that the caffeine-addicted public would not abide it. But what really began to concern local rulers was not the drink itself, but where it was consumed. First on the street, then outside stalls in the market, and finally in dedicated coffee houses, full of excited and caffeinated chatter, hotbeds of rumors and discussion, which often concerned politics or sensitive ideas, that authority figures would certainly not like to hear going on. Political discussions turn to political resentment and malcontent. Those can turn into outright dissent and rebellion. Coffee houses were seen as dangerous breeding grounds for sedition and revolution, leading to many more attempts across the Arab world to close them down. But again, despite these efforts, and despite the resulting reputation of coffee drinkers as gossips and troublemakers, attempts to shut down the coffee house industry were as unsuccessful as trying to ban coffee itself. Coffee culture had arrived quickly, and it was here to stay. By the 1600s, as the age of exploration and colonialism was really heating up, Europeans had noticed how popular coffee houses had become across Muslim lands. They noted particularly that, although there was a lack of tavern and wine and ale houses, instead there were lots of coffee houses, which were similar and yet not at all like a bar. The atmosphere was upbeat and full of energy, as opposed to sunken and dark and alcoholic. At first, Europeans were perplexed at this, and also at coffee's strong, definitely acquired taste. One English traveler wrote that coffee was prepared as hot as they can suffer it, black as soot, and tasting not much unlike it. Some Europeans argued that coffee, because of its association with Islam, was evil. They argued that because Muslims couldn't drink wine, that God had punished them with coffee instead. But don't knock it till you try it. Pope Clement VIII was asked in 1605 to rule on the church's official position for coffee, which was starting to see some popularity in Europe. When he was provided a small sample, the Pope supposedly was so enamored with its aroma and flavor that he immediately approved and encouraged its consumption by Christians. Not 50 years later, this just recently exotic novelty was turning up in cities all over Europe, and with it came coffee houses to drink it in, as a more respectable and temperate alternative to taverns. They were well lit, adorned with books, mirrors, art, and good furniture. London's first coffee house showed up in 1652, opened by an Armenian with Iranian coffee connections named Pasca Rossi. So new was this beverage at the time that the first cups came with pamphlets explaining coffee's origin, how it was prepared, and the customs that went along with drinking it. It promised coffee could help sore eyes, headaches, coughs, gout, and scurvy, even miscarriages. Some of these treatments are accurate and some not so much. Probably most true and effective was this blurb in the advertisement. Coffee will prevent drowsiness and make one fit for business, so much so that you are not to drink of it after supper unless you intend to be watchful, for it will hinder sleep for 3 or 4 hours. Rossi's coffee house was so successful that taverns protested and tried to shut him down. He was ultimately forced out, but it was too late to stop the idea of a coffee house from taking hold. Not 10 years later, London had 83 of them. Many were destroyed in the Great London Fire of 1666, but even more popped up in their place afterwards. By 1700, there were hundreds of cafes. One authority deemed that there were probably 3,000 altogether in London. Most likely an exaggeration, but it just shows what the perception at the time must have been. Coffee shops, filling every street and corner, worse than Starbucks in the late 90s. Despite the rapid rise, some people did take a while longer to come around to that strong and bitter taste. One of the early nicknames coffee acquired was syrup of soot, or essence of old shoes. Man, I love coffee, but can you really argue with those descriptions? The fact that at the time, coffee was taxed by the gallon and thus had to be made in advance didn't help. Picture the flavor of early European coffee like this. You walk into your favorite coffee house and you order a dish. The proprietor certainly wasn't making it to order. Again, that wasn't allowed, even if he wanted to. Instead, coffee sellers kept pots of pre-made, reheated stuff over a fire on a low boil all day long, or until it was gone and had to be replaced with a new kettle. Have you ever had coffee that's been sitting on a warmer all day or longer? Yeah, it would have been like that, but times 10. That's what everybody was drinking and mostly loving every drop of. That only further demonstrates the power of caffeine over humans. But most people weren't concerned with coffee's flavor. Similarly to in the Islamic world, some began to worry about the coffee houses themselves, arguing that they encouraged time-wasting and trivial discussion at the expense of more useful or important things. I'll come back to just how wrong that belief was, but just for now know that it was a legitimate concern at the time. But even more worrying than idleness were the rumors and heated political ideas that flowed as readily as the brew itself. The recently ascended King Charles II, in particular, knew how dangerous coffee houses could be. His own rise to the throne might not have been possible if not for gatherings of supporters in cafes, hatching plots and machinations for power, and planning the reestablishment of the British monarchy over steaming cups of coffee. So naturally, Charles, after these coffeehouse plots had recently made him king, pulled the ladder up behind him and tried to suppress and close cafes all over England. The public outcry was potent. By then, coffeehouses had already become central to the social and economic life of London. When the king saw he was being ignored, and thus his legitimacy threatened over his stance on coffeehouses, he quickly dialed things back and allowed coffee sellers to stay open if they followed new rules and taxes. But even that soon gave way to vague platitudes about coffeehouses promising to refuse entry to, quote, spies and mischief makers. So not even kings could stop the spread of coffee. In Arabia, Islamic territory, or Europe, too. Here's one memorable quote that illustrates the situation from a writer in the Netherlands. "Coffee's use has become so common in our country that unless the maids and seamstresses have their coffee every morning, the thread will not go through the eye of the needle." When coffee reached Germany, composer Johann Sebastian Bach, on the rise at the time, wrote a coffee cantata in praise of it and in derision of those who opposed it. Soon popular in France, too, despite resistance, the Arabic drink had conquered Northern Europe. Problem was that Arabs still controlled the world's entire supply. Regional coffee growers across Arabia and Ethiopia brought their harvest to Mecca, which went by camel caravan through Egypt to the Mediterranean. In the port of Alexandria, Venetian and later other European merchants brought this coffee wholesale to take and sell back home, and that was the only source. And though Europeans were soon clamoring for more and more of it, Arabs protected this monopoly aggressively. They treated beans so that they could not sprout and grow new plants, and foreigners were not allowed on coffee farms or plantations or production zones to protect trade secrets. But caffeine addiction is very real, and the Europeans were persistent enough to eventually break through and acquire their own supplies. How did they do that? It's sort of a long story, and gets us back into some of the really big picture historical stuff, some of which we established last episode. You see, coffee was just one of the several luxury goods Europeans were pursuing abroad lately, and they were sparing no expense doing so. Colonization and the Columbian Exchange were already transforming Europe, Asia, and Africa. And as new foods and precious metals poured into their economies, they created entirely new ways of looking at and interacting with the world at large. The world had become so much larger and expansive and rich than any of them could have imagined. Gold and silver, spices, sugar and liquor, and now coffee too. And Europe occupied the central position to exploit it all. It was the lust and search for all these new worldly goods which would drive world history for many generations to come. For soon, Europeans found themselves in a bit of a paradox that's still a little hard to grasp. Acquiring these colonial commodities provided wealth, but it also created a need for funding in order to maintain the supply lines for this wealth to keep flowing. As things got more expensive and as commodity prices fell, the only option was to always expand production more and more, meaning more resource wealth is needed to acquire more resources. Welcome to the traps of modern capitalism, where it's either expand and grow or die. Europe had to invent commerce and modern economics on the fly to deal with theirs and the world's new, unprecedented situation. But we don't call this colonial era that of capitalism just yet. It's actually a much more primitive form of it to start. The era and the economic philosophy that was beginning to take shape now in the 16 and 1700s is known as the Age of Mercantilism. What that meant is best described as zero-sum economics. Mercantilists viewed the world economy as a zero-sum game, meaning that any party's gain came at another party's loss. You can't acquire anything if someone else doesn't lose something. And that means that a state could only gain wealth and power by harming another state. Rulers saw any action that benefited a rival as, by definition, harmful to themselves. Economics became a highly selfish enterprise, a competition between the most powerful. So none of the world's wealth could be used to improve the common good, only to benefit the state and its highest actors. This situation was almost guaranteed to happen by all that mineral wealth flowing in from America. Gold and silver had been expensive, coveted luxury goods for thousands of years already, yes. But now, states began to define their entire economies on them. Pretty soon, how many shiny rocks a nation-state had was an indicator of how powerful they were. This is something that seems obvious to us today, as we still think about gold and silver as the main means of wealth and luxury, and less so about other goods as forms of wealth. But it didn't have to end up this way, and it was by no means a foregone conclusion at the time. Historically, up until this point, probably the most common and recognized source of wealth was how much food a state had. But with more and more and more silver flowing in and forcing its way into the money supply, Europe's twisting and transformation into Mercantine's monster was almost unavoidable. And this is what drives all the famous colonialism that was to come. Controlling supplies of silver, as well as expensive luxury goods like sugar, spices, and coffee that could be sold for silver, meant controlling colonies. Asia, oceanic islands, and America, where all these things could be obtained. Gaining control of a colony or a shipping route meant taking it from somebody else. War and pillage became good economics. With all the world's wealth at stake, European powers soon found themselves in a globe-spanning, mercantilist struggle against each other for supremacy. Skirmishes all over the globe with colonies and territories, both land and sea, trading hands faster than anybody could keep up. This is all sort of the final phase in a sudden, recent shift in the center of world power from the land to the sea. And with that, the shift from the major centers of civilization being warmer, closer to the equator and subtropical regions like India, the Fertile Crescent, and the Mediterranean, now to the north, colder parts of the world. As world shipping took over everyone's focus, access to the sea and the sea power they developed made Atlantic states the new centers of historical activity and human progress. At first, it was Spain and Portugal, kicking things off and exploring and plundering the Americas and East Asia, getting rich and powerful in the process. But soon, new economic powerhouses would enter the game. England, the Netherlands, France, these states quickly became heavy hitters on the world stage in their own right, largely thanks to a new way of governing, or should I say, doing business. As the scope of all that world ripe for colonizing came into view, there were various entities and companies and corporations out there exploiting it on their own. Nations themselves wanted to get in on this, but they didn't do so directly. Instead, they formed a supposedly private company, usually out of a merger of several different smaller ones, who received extra special treatment from the government. These national megacorporations were granted full monopolies in their trades, and given the right to represent the state itself in their business dealings abroad. It was private enterprise, but backed by the government. Today, we call this government intervening in private business picking winners and losers. This was that offense taken to the extreme, with the state itself being the winner and forcing all the losers out. State-backed monopolies were the best way for governments to compete, especially with other governments. An enormous company with state power behind it can easily muscle in on just about any competitor's territory, stealing colonies and pushing out smaller companies and aggressively establishing trade networks of their own for the home country. It was the Dutch people of the Netherlands who were really the first ones to pioneer this approach to running a country. In 1602, they formed the Dutch East India Company to control and manage Dutch trading ventures overseas. At this time, the Netherlands is watching Spain and Portugal develop its trade routes around southern Africa into the Indian Ocean and the Spice Islands of the Far East. So, what does the Dutch East India Company do? This is the age of mercantilism. Of course they declare war on Portugal. One by one, they dealt with every Portuguese colony in Asia and the Pacific, especially in the vast Indonesian archipelago, or what was called at the time the Spice Islands. DEI Incorporated, as I'd like to think they'd call themselves today, established colonies in South Africa too, taking control of its coastline, as well as the critical choke point and stop-offs from Europe to Asia. They attacked Sri Lanka and took control of the cinnamon trade. They conquered the Banda Islands, where cloves and nutmeg came from, as well as many others in between. They also took the city of Malacca, which was the crucial trading port tying all of these islands together. Suddenly, the Dutch had complete control of the international spice trade, and had supplanted the Portuguese, and thus the Spanish, as the leading world commercial power. For quite some time afterwards, the Netherlands was the king of commerce the world over, and the wealthiest nation on earth. Once the Dutch had a firm grip on the Indian Ocean and the Spice Islands, they further broadened their monopoly. They muscled in on the tea, silk, and porcelain trade in China, and somehow managed to get exclusive rights with the notoriously isolationist Edo, Japan. For the next 200 years, a corner of the port city Nagasaki was the only place foreigners were allowed to reside in Japan, period, and it was only the Dutch who were permitted. They even made some ventures west once things started heating up in the Americas. The Dutch practically took over Brazil and littered it with sugar plantations. They also set up the colony of New Amsterdam on swampy Long Island. But they mostly seem to forget about it as they lose control of it to the English and it becomes New York. Little did the Dutch know that that dinky colony in the Northwest Atlantic boonies would someday soon become the world's new financial capital, supplanting Amsterdam and making its occupants wish they'd paid more attention to it. Most crucial to our story today were a couple of other quote-unquote spice islands back in the East Indies, and how the Dutch recognized their potential to grow the latest luxury hot commodity that everybody back home just couldn't get enough of. Yup, don't worry, I didn't forget this episode is about coffee. Dutch sailors had successfully smuggled cuttings of coffee trees out of Arabia and brought them to the islands of Sumatra and Java in the 1690s. You might recognize those place names as being synonymous with coffee today, and that's because of how well it thrives there. Within just a few years, Java coffee shipped directly to Amsterdam gave the Dutch full control of the world's coffee market. Breaking the Arab monopoly meant shattering their high prices. Dutch coffee was sold dirt cheap, and Arabian coffee couldn't compete on the market. Although, wealthy connoisseurs still preferred it for its supposedly superior flavor. It was the mercantilist ambitions of the Dutch East India Company, transforming those wonderful black beans from an expensive niche item into a class-spanning sensation that would sweep the continent and surge in popularity. But that's actually only half the picture of early European coffee culture. Dutch coffee islands flooded the market and spread the beans around, yes, but it was in England, especially in the city of London, that coffee would find its first true home, and where drinking it, in cafes, became a lifestyle all its own. And that would change the face of the continent and the world. While the Dutch and their East India Company's hostile takeover of Spanish and Portuguese assets were the first official mercantile empire, it was actually the English who first pioneered much of its practical approaches to trade, colonialism, and war in the decades prior. Before all this really got going was the Elizabethan era of the late 1500s, and along with much of Northern Europe, England found itself under the shadow and control of the powerful Spanish Empire, which was throwing its newfound wealth and power around and trying to control much of Europe. Queen Elizabeth knew that she had to establish both wealth and trading power in order to survive in this rapidly changing world. She famously poured resources into developing a navy and a merchant fleet which could challenge Spanish supremacy. English privateers were state-sanctioned pirates who terrorized Spanish colonies and ships, stealing enormous amounts of wealth and reinvesting it in their own commerce and military. This new English navy famously defeated the enormously larger Spanish Armada in 1588, and from that, it was off to the colonial races. The British East and West India Companies were soon formed specifically to compete with the Dutch versions, as the English muscled in on their worldly profits. They were on their way to becoming the most powerful navy and the most powerful state on Earth. But that's later down the line, actually not till the 1800s. For now, they're just laying foundations. And you can describe England's colonial ventures in the beginning as mixed successes. Alongside the famous victories are the catastrophic failures and losses. The English attempted to make American tobacco their version of Spanish sugar or Dutch spices and coffee. You get the disasters of the failed colonies of Roanoke and others, where countless Europeans migrated to and subsequently died of starvation or malaria. Personally insulated from all that failure and death, English businessmen back home were persistent and kept stubbornly funding one doomed venture after another until they were successful. Only Jamestown would just barely survive and give England its crucial foothold in the Americas, which I don't think I need to say will be important down the line. But I'll talk more about that another time when we get into the history of the USA itself. Lastly, among the major mercantilist powers of the day, though, I just want to talk a little about France, who, while the most populous and thus the most economically important nation in Europe at the time, was a little late getting into the colonial game. The French had sent a couple expeditions but didn't even have any permanent settlements yet. But they eventually found their opening in North America, in what's today modern Quebec, as well as the American Midwest and Great Lakes region, in the fur and trapping industry. The Company of 100 Associates was the French version of the National Megacorporation, formed in 1628. In addition to developing what would become a huge American industry at this time, they set up many important ports like New Orleans, and brought sugar and coffee to Caribbean islands they wrested from the Dutch, the Spanish, and the English, like Martinique, Haiti, Cuba, as well as mainland Costa Rica and Venezuela, all major coffee producers today. Now, with the French shipping boatloads of coffee back home from the Caribbean, as well as the Dutch continuing to ship it west from the Spice Islands, the coffee surplus in Europe was taken into overload. So we've got Spain and Portugal, England, the Netherlands, and France, tearing it up around the world, trading goods, stealing colonies, making money, It all seems so industrious and adventurous when you only tell it from their perspective. There, of course, were some terrible consequences. Mercantilism is not a good economic system for long-term financial health. Markets and money systems were volatile and destructive throughout this period, ravaging wealthy and poor people alike. War and conflict transcended to a global stage. The fighting got so intense that an Austrian territory dispute turned into this giant, globe-spanning conflict between all the major powers of the day, many middling powers as well, and all of their colonial assets, duking it out in what's called the Seven Years' War, or in the US, the French and Indian War. Winston Churchill referred to this epic conflict as the first real world war, and he's kinda right. The whole earth was at war, fighting all over it. More than a million soldiers and civilians were dead by the end of it. As we discuss all this, getting to more colonial food and drink and making our way to the fun, positive effects of coffee taking over Europe, it's really important to keep in mind that there is a whole other terrible side to all this, that of the colonized. The European powers attacked and burned each other's plantations and colonies with little heed for the lives of the innocent people living and working them, caught in the cannon fire. They treated every colony but their own with this attitude, and things weren't better once they established control at their own plantations. Colonial ventures had the potential to make their investors exceedingly rich, but they were expensive to initially get off the ground, and that led to some very shady and morally dubious business practices. Coffee, sugar, tobacco, and spice plantations all needed a tremendous amount of labor to operate. Last episode, we discussed the slave trade in the Americas. Colonizers abroad didn't usually resort to this outright practice of enslaving native populations, but they didn't offer them good pay and benefits or anything like that either. With the rest of their community often recently destroyed, locals had no choice but to work for their colonial masters. They were paid in wages for their hard labor, but then forced to buy all of their food and living supplies from their Dutch overlords, creating this exploitive situation of total dependence. And this was all based on the success of the crops. If the market for their particular commodity suffered and prices fell, the people who grew it would starve. All over the world, the Europeans, with their head start on imperial civilization, thanks to their shipbuilding and navigational cheat codes, wrecked entire societies and peoples, just so they could have more luxury goods back home at cheaper prices. We'll see soon that coffee, especially, did great things for Europe, but it came at a horrible price for the rest of the world. That is, the more complete, much darker story of how coffee came to Europe. Colonial war and exploitation. Thankfully, all that ugliness is behind us. Or is it? In 1776, Adam Smith would publish The Wealth of Nations, describing how countries can utilize other, more complex sources of wealth besides gold and silver, thereby tearing apart and ending the mercantilist system, outlining instead a new, more cooperation and trade-focused, as opposed to Bernie and pillagey and gold and silver-focused kind of economy. Smith invented modern capitalism and free market economics in the process. And while this isn't going to be an economics of food podcast, any amateur chef economists out there want to fill that niche? I just want to point out that many of the toughest and most valid criticisms of modern capitalism today stem from its predecessor at this time, the mercantilist system of the 17th and 18th centuries. Profits at the expense of all else, quashing competition, protectionism, picking winners and losers, zero-sum thinking, the global increase of wealth inequality. Despite Western nations all eventually upgrading to Adam Smith's way of doing things, all these flaws have remained. In this way, and in many other ways, the legacy of colonialism and mercantilism is still with us. So with that understanding percolating in our brains, I think it's safe to proceed to the fun stuff, because despite all that misery, some good did come of all this. Now we know a bit about how coffee came to Europe. But what did the widespread arrival of cheap coffee mean for a continent that was unfamiliar with it, and already undergoing rapid changes for other reasons? Was everybody just more energetic and amped up all the time? That's one way to put it, but I think you could get a lot more complex. What were Europeans drinking before discovering coffee in the 1600s? Most people still like to start their day with a beverage, and at the time, beer and wine were still the dominant drinks across the continent. So most people, rich or poor, started their day with alcohol, or even made it their entire breakfast. This had been the case since the beginning of civilization and alcohol itself. Everybody was drinking beer and wine all the time, meaning that for all that time, most people across history were starting their day with a little buzz, and then probably continuing to nurse it throughout the day. It's not like everybody was sloshed all the time, but the entire population, probably without even realizing it, was living in a constant, mildly inebriated fog all the time. Now, for physical laborers across history working outdoors, beer actually makes a pretty good breakfast or lunch. It's calorically nutritious, and drunk strength is a real thing. But alcohol, of course, fogs the mind too. And this began to become a problem as Europe's trades and financial systems grew more complex in the mercantile era, with more people in the growing middle class working with numbers or machines. Enter coffee, right on cue. A drink that was not only safer than water, beer, or wine, thanks to the need to boil it, but it also improved energy and mental stamina, as opposed to distracting from them. As coffee began to make the rounds, those who drank it began their day alert and stimulated, instead of relaxed, numb, and a little lazy. The quality of their work and the amount of work they got done, of course, improved as a result, and their minds were clearer to think of novel ideas. Among its early fans, coffee came to be known as the antithesis of alcohol. Beer was derided as foggy ale that besieges brains, while wine was derided as sweet poison of the treacherous grape that drowns reason and the soul. The adoption of coffee by elite and commoner alike heralded a new era of clear-headedness, modernity, and progress. Some historians call the forthcoming era the Age of Reason, or the Enlightenment, but I prefer to call it the Great Sobering, as coffee helped the continent awaken from a millennia-long alcoholic haze. Much like today, caffeine addicts of the Great Sobering largely didn't brew their coffee at home, but instead took it at coffee houses, which were soon popping up everywhere and displacing many establishments that sold alcohol. As coffee houses began to edge out taverns, they became the new local watering hole, where neighbors and communities could gather, only with more productive, caffeinated beverages on the menu. Thus, these early cafes soon began to transcend being simple places to quench your thirst. A European in the 17th century could do quite a lot of things for the price of a cup of coffee. He could chat with other patrons, catch up on all the local news and gossip, read the latest pamphlets and newsletters or circulate his own publications, keep up with the latest scientific developments, check stock and commodity prices or strike business deals, just the broad strokes of what coffee houses were becoming. Most important, a coffee house patron could hang out and drink coffee with people in his circle of interest, as many cafes began specializing in particular areas. Some were all about business and finance news. Others subscribed to foreign newsletters and interests from faraway places. Others were associated with specific trades, gathering notes for merchants, writers, actors, musicians, sailors, scientists, who could all come together in the same location and exchange ideas together. Rumors, news, and gossip flew between coffee houses. Occasionally, runners would dash from one to another yelling some major piece of news of the day. Coffee houses formed a unique bridge between public and private worlds, as both spheres came together in one Venn diagram of an area, forming and reacting to public opinion simultaneously. Naturally, this was fertile ground for intellectual activity and growth. Coffee houses were like information exchanges, vibrant, comprehensive, but often unreliable sources of ideas and news. One can't help but notice the similarities to the internet today. How Facebook and Twitter have all the news and like-minded people you could ever want, but are also rumor mills of fake news and misinformation. Even though coffee shops were specialized, they were also deeply connected to each other, and ideas and innovation would spread from one cafe to another, kind of like a network. Each coffee house node connected to the greater whole, connected further by patrons who frequented multiple shops. Again, you can't escape the comparison with websites or social networks. It's true. During Europe's Great Sobering, as Tom Standage puts in his book A History of the World in Six Glasses, coffee houses, collectively, functioned as the internet in pre-industrial Europe. It remains to be seen if social networks will end up being tools of human progress or lead to our dumbing down and downfall, but coffee houses definitely were the former in Europe, hotbeds of innovation and progress. This was especially true in London, which didn't have the very first European coffee house. Again, that award goes to the Dutch, but London definitely was the most vibrant. By 1700, there were coffee districts around the city, with each shop being in one and having its own specialty and unique sign over the door. Merchants and businessmen began keeping regular hours at particular coffee houses so that their associates could always know where to find them. Cafes were used in lieu of an office in other ways too, as meeting rooms, trade venues, auction and sale sites. Many people even made coffee houses their permanent mail address. Regulars at a particular place could pop in a couple times a day, drink a dish of coffee, hear the latest news, and check to see if any mail or packages had come for them. The coffee house became the middle-class Londoner's home, as many spent all day there, doing just about everything in their lives short of sleeping. Obviously, common wisdom became not to ask for a person's home address, but rather which cafe they frequented. Londoners consumed more coffee than just about anybody else. Soon, coffeehouse culture had impressioned itself onto the broader culture at large, leading to some radical social changes that distinguished London from all other cities. I need to point out here that women, aka half the human population, were excluded from coffeehouses. This is still pre-modern Europe after all, but with that significant exception, coffee culture was surprisingly egalitarian. Anyone male, regardless of class, background, or profession, was allowed to be admitted, expected to all sit together and to leave their social differences at the door. Anybody could debate or question anybody else. If a local street sweeper thought that some rich aristocrat was spouting BS, he could call him out on it. Civility and high-mindedness were encouraged instead. If any debate turned into a shouting match or, heaven forbid, some sort of uncouth tavern brawl, the offenders were kicked out, or at the least forced to atone by buying a round of coffee for everybody present. This was the coffee house, not some brothel or bar. Coffee culture was just the beginning for so many things that were to come, as ideas and inventions born in cafes evolved into practical innovation out in the real world. We'll get to my personally favorite stuff, the science and philosophy, but first it seems to me we should connect what was going on in coffeehouses with the mercantile and colonial system governing the world at the time. In short, the world of commerce and finance gave Europeans access to coffee, and coffee would return the favor by shaping the world of commerce and finance. Because the drink was so popular, growing or selling coffee was good business, and drinking coffee made people better at business, more creative, more capable of caffeine-fueled ingenuity. The financial profits from all that coffee, sugar, and spice didn't exactly hurt economic progress either. Any way you look at it, coffee and Europe's emerging form of primitive capitalism were made for each other. It also helped to regulate the modern working day. Since our beginnings, human beings have awoken, worked, and slept according to the sun. But coffee freed us from those circadian rhythms, pushing back exhaustion so we could push the length of the workday and work longer hours later, too. Michael Pollan points out that, probably not coincidentally, the arrival of coffee is the same historical moment that clockmakers invent and popularize the minute hand, a first for timepieces. Right as work was being moved more indoors and being reorganized with minutes and hours within the day. Many novel business models that hadn't existed in the world until that point were born in English coffee shops. Insurance, joint stock schemes and companies, lotteries. One of the best examples is a particular coffee house in London in the 1680s owned by one Edward Lloyd. It was a common hangout for traders, ship captains, builders, and ship owners. Pretty soon, another key type of client was gathering at Lloyd's. Investors, underwriters who funded and thus insured these ships and their voyages. Many underwriters established semi-permanent booths at Lloyd's Coffee House. And all these previously disparate insurers, pioneering this very new line of work, were now together in one place, forming one brain made of individuals sharing cups of coffee. In 1771, a group of 79 of these regular underwriters at Lloyd's came together and established the Society of Lloyd's, surviving to this day as Lloyd's of London, the world's leading insurance market. Another new and underdeveloped concept that found a home and got a boost in coffee houses was commodity trading and stock markets. Companies selling off pieces of themselves to investors was not invented in London coffee houses. It was pioneered earlier in the Netherlands. The Dutch East India Company was actually the first entity in history to issue bonds and shares of stock to the general public. So while the coffee revolution was still brewing, London already had a thriving stock market. Stocks were traded by a few wealthy folks in the know at the city's Royal Exchange, its center of commerce. But as trading got more popular and the number of investors and middlemen brokers rose, the government feared financial instability and tried to pass laws limiting the amount of trading. Stockbrokers were enraged. In protest, they walked out of the Royal Exchange and instead set up shop in nearby coffee houses. One shop in particular, called Jonathan's, quickly became known as the center of London's stock trading. Most of the city's major brokers began advertising it as their main office. Naturally, having coffee shops be your city's economic heart, especially in a major city like London, has its problems. Chaos and uncertain markets, defaulters running rampant from cafe to cafe. Those traders who crashed and burned were banned from Jonathan's, but that meant they could simply set up shop and trade somewhere else. In one case, in 1773, a group of brokers broke away from Jonathan's and set up in a brand new cafe they creatively dubbed New Jonathan's. Eventually, they decided to name it something more official, and they called it the Stock Exchange. That hasty pop-up coffee shop would go on to become the London Stock Exchange. Yes, the London Stock Exchange, one of the world's most important financial centers today. This era of rapid innovation in finance and economics helped London knock Amsterdam out of the top slot and become the world's financial center. It's often called the Financial Revolution, and it was driven not just by caffeine-fueled ingenuity, but also deep needs in the colonial world that Europe was building abroad. The need to fund expensive colonial wars, build and defend plantations, control laborers, safely ship product, all were constantly creating problems for would-be mercantilists. But together, in coffee shops, they found ways to come together and solve them. If not for the world and humanity's benefit, then at least for their own profits. But hey, that's just business, right? It was in those very same coffee shops that our friend from earlier, Adam Smith, wrote his masterpiece, The Wealth of Nations, and thereby created modern laissez-faire capitalism. It's pretty hard to overstate just how monumental this book was, especially for our world today. Smith used a coffee shop as his home address, his writing office, and as a place to circulate chapters to test readers for criticism. And so it was that modern capitalism in its early form found its voice through caffeine. It's the beginning of a love story between the two that will span the ages. We'll talk more about that with the arrival of tea and industry in future episodes. Today, though, let's stick to pre-industrial coffee just a little while longer. There is more to life than money, even in mercantile Europe. The world of finance was not the only world changed by coffee houses. Something much bigger was brewing. And no, I will not stop repeating the same coffee metaphors. Remember that all this coffee drinking and influence that cafes suddenly had didn't sit right with everyone. From a conservative, non-caffeinated perspective, it seemed that idleness and distraction were on the rise. The truth, though, was that those guys had it completely backwards. Coffee doesn't make people idle, it motivates them. And rather than being distracting, caffeine lubricates the gears of the mind, helping it stay focused, active, and energized, promoting good ideas and good work ethic to flesh them out. Those positive traits extended to the cafes themselves, which were soon nicknamed penny universities, since anyone of any background could enter and get a day's worth of education for a penny, the price of a cup of coffee. In fact, class at the coffee house might have been more educational than those at traditional universities at the time. Rather than being stiff, antiquated, and formal, coffee houses were relaxed and had an atmosphere of open discussion, with speculation and new ideas flowing rampant. Eventually, lectures and debates in formal academic settings would continue afterwards into the coffee houses, where they could be expounded upon and fleshed out in ways not possible in a classroom. Coffee drinkers could float half-formed ideas without fear. Many of these were probably half-baked or harebrained, but a few were brilliant. Perhaps most notable of all the myriad types of specialty cafes popping up were those devoted to science, or natural philosophy as it was known at the time. For centuries, that field had remained dead, or at least stagnant, looking forever backwards and still dominated by what the ancient Greeks had written. What a few smart dudes were basically guessing about the natural world thousands of years ago, based on what they could see and what made sense to their human logic, was still dogma to Europeans throughout the Middle Ages and even much of the early modern period. Nothing about people's understanding of the universe ever changed. Why would it? As far as they were concerned, there was nothing to change. Religion had any answers to cosmic or existential questions, and if not the church, then you could turn to Aristotle. But something had begun to change, ever since Columbus found the New World and opened Europe up to the idea that new things could exist out there, that the old, infallible givens might not be so given after all. And so people began to question them. One of the earliest pioneers of this thinking was an English lord named Francis Bacon, who in 1620 outlined the basic scientific method still followed today. He compared natural philosophy to a fruit tree. New fruit trees are grafted from already existing trees. Just like scientific knowledge at that time was based on ancient, already thought-out texts. Unlike a fruit tree, a true understanding of the natural world cannot be grafted from an old idea. It must begin from seed, completely anew, with all old assumptions and branches thrown out. Unless humanity wanted to live through the ages going in perpetual intellectual cycles nowhere, everything needed to be challenged, and nothing could be assumed. Once again, nothing is better than food analogies at describing life, the universe, and everything. Bacon's ideas spread amongst Europe's elite. Many historians argue that this new scientific rationalism was driven by the challenges of colonialism, figuring out ways to exploit far-flung colonies for profit from the comfort of their home country. Northern Europeans solved logistical problems with rational scientific thinking, which is why the scientific revolution that was beginning found its home mainly in England and the Netherlands. Over the next two centuries, the spirit of scientific thinking spread into the general consciousness. It was applied to all aspects of life, politics, religion, commerce, of course. When all the disparate writings and experiments began to come together into something of a continental consensus amongst universities and elite thinkers, the age of reason had begun. People could see and investigate the world as it really is, from basic principles, discover unseen worlds and truths. This culminated in what's called the Enlightenment, when Western thinkers finally moved out of the shadow of the ancients and opened themselves up to progress, inventing much of the technology that would start us down the path of industrialization. If not driven by it, it was at least a counterpoint to the age of exploration happening at the same time. A new world of knowledge colonized in the collective human brain to match the literal colonies in the literal new world of the Americas. And you know I'm gonna say it, we have coffee to thank for all of it. It wasn't just that the spirit of intellectual awakening in Europe was so mirrored by the industrious coffeehouse culture. The coffeehouse culture is likely directly responsible for much of that intellectual awakening. All those ideas and thinkers coming together, bouncing off one another, and the networks connecting them between other coffeehouses was like fuel for the people driving this revolution. Take just this one stunning example. In 1684, in a London coffeehouse, two Royal Society members were having a scientific discussion over some evening brew. They were the boastful but smart thinker named Robert Hooke, not super famous today, but responsible for many advances and ideas at the time, and then one Edmund Halley, yes, of the comet. They were talking about some big ideas, really big, like planetary-sized. They were discussing gravity, a topic of much wonder and speculation at the time, and debating if the well-known inverse square law of mathematics could be used to describe and account for the orbits and movements of the planets. At this time, no one knew, and the idea of gravity and planets remained nothing more than a fun what-if over some late-night coffee. But a few months later, on a trip to Cambridge, Halley visited another scientific colleague, one Isaac Newton, at that point an accomplished physicist whose star was rising, but not nearly at Isaac Newton-level famous just yet. That was about to change. Edmund Halley recalled his coffeehouse discussion with Hooke and posed the same question to Newton. Newton claimed to know the answer that, yes, an inverse-square relationship would cause planetary orbits to behave how they do, and that the math would show it. But he couldn't come up with proof on the spot. Yet the problem gnawed at him, and Newton spent the next few years not only proving Halley's question, but so much more. The coffeehouse debate had given him the push he needed to formalize and finish years of half-made ideas and works, and to publish one of the greatest works in the history of science, Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica, or the Principia for short, in which Newton demonstrated how this principle of universal gravitation could explain both the motions of objects in the heavens as well as the Earth. He also invented calculus and many other high-level maths we use today by accident in the process. With the Principia, Newton locked in the theory of gravity and established physics and science for the next several centuries. He finally and fully discredited the Greek ideas about the universe and built a foundation of understanding that would not be obsolete until Einstein in the 20th century. And even after that, Newton's equations and laws are still incredibly useful today in all but the most extreme conditions for physics. They describe just about any motion or event of practical human life on Earth that you could imagine. Newton took the physical reality that we all experience as humans and described and predicted it with numbers and equations, abstraction made concrete. The universe, after eons, submitted to human reason. And for that, Newton is widely regarded, probably justifiably so, as the greatest scientist in history. And it all started with a casual but heated discussion over cups of coffee. Or at least the inspiration did. It's technically accurate to say it all began in a coffee house, but it's more accurate to say that coffee houses provided the fuel to take human potential and give it the energy to actually manifest into something real and practical. It's funny, actually. Hook would end up getting a little mad and try to take credit, insisting that he had given the idea of this gravitational inverse square question to Newton. And while sort of true, there's a big difference between floating a crazy idea in a coffee house and actually setting out to prove it. Still, point taken, Professor Hook. We have coffee to thank for fueling the scientific revolution. The connection between science and coffee houses would only grow more structured from then on. Cafes were becoming popular venues for academic lectures. Again, without entrance or tuition to university, coffee drinkers could come see the latest microscopes, telescopes, prisms, pumps, springs, you name it. From astronomy to microscopy and beyond. These open lectures in coffee shops helped to popularize and spread the ideas of science. Merchants and sailors realized that it could help improve their navigation and commercial success. More abstract ideas turned practical as entrepreneurs and academics teamed up to exploit new technologies in navigation, mining, manufacturing, and kicking off what's called proto-industrialization. This isn't the famous Industrial Revolution yet, but it is laying the groundwork for it. That's a couple hundred years off still, but I'm just making the point that coffee houses play an early role in the spread of ideas that will propel it. But more importantly, their practicalization of ideas into things are changing how the world works. Similar happenings were brewing in not just the world of natural philosophy, but of philosophy too. Coffeehouse debates and ideas developed a whole new perspective on the nature of man, of liberty, and human rights. By turning their backs on dogma and turning instead to openness, tolerance, humanism, criticism, and above all, freedom of thought. Freedom in general, actually. Philosophers like Locke, Rousseau, Kant, Descartes, they all write about man's noble and innate nature, his need to be free, and the social contract that we all owe to each other. In many ways, these Enlightenment philosophers took the egalitarian nature of the coffee house and applied it to the rest of the world. If people of all backgrounds and classes can drink and talk as equals in the coffee house, then why not in the rest of life as well? In fact, American forefather Thomas Jefferson would end up writing into the American Declaration of Independence words that were pretty much directly lifted from the thinkers of this era, forged in the coffee houses of Europe, but then tested out in a brand new country and experiment somewhere else. Those same ideas spread into the growing coffeehouse culture in Paris and other cities across France, causing people everywhere reading these new radical thoughts about equality and human rights to wonder why they didn't have some of those nice things. It's hard to imagine Paris today without its cafes, but coffee shops were brand new at this time, and slower to arrive than in London or Amsterdam. They played a direct role in fostering the sentiments and conditions that would set up the French Revolution. Political writers and dissidents made coffee shops their home. One of my personal favorites, Voltaire, was known to practically live in his favorite cafe and drink dozens, yes, dozens of cups per day. In France, even women were allowed to participate, and people were seeing that equality in coffee shops and growing more and more discontent with the disparity between that and their own lives. Naturally, the crown and the aristocracy grew alarmed at the trouble that was brewing, but it was too late. Calls to arms and for citizens to storm the Bastille and take control of their nation began in coffee shops, as did the demonstration that life could be better for all people if the world worked a little bit more like those cafes. I don't want to oversimplify here. The causes of the American and then the French Revolution are numerous and quite complex, but coffee and coffee house culture definitely played a part, especially when it came to giving fuel to all those centuries of class warfare and resentment, igniting them into revolution. I don't need to do the whole conclusion-y thing where I go over how important caffeine and coffee are today and how they run the modern world, right? That's self-evident to almost everybody listening, I think, since almost all of us participate in its consumption. So let's stick with coffee's side effects on history. The birth of proto-industrialization and the modern world taking shape, these effects of caffeine meshing perfectly with the needs of colonialism and capitalism. We saw the numerous ways that Europe saw enormous benefit from coffee, but we also saw how it was obtained through nefarious or, at best, unethical means, exploiting populations around the world with protectionist, crony mercantilism. As often seems to be, the success of the Western world was built on the backs and at the expense of others. And while we've gotten better about this today, with labor laws and global awareness about workers' rights, this fundamental, exploitive nature in the system is still very much with us. Sweatshops, income inequality, wealth hoarding. Look, let me be clear. I'm not anti-capitalist. In fact, as socialism rises in popularity, I probably believe in the good capitalism has done and can do much more than most people in my demographic these days. But unregulated capitalism, pure business interest unleashed upon the world with no restraints upon it, but the morality of individual human beings, updated mercantilism, in other words, yeah, that's sort of what we have going on now, and it's not working out so good. To understand how, coffee will once again provide one final example. You see, the long and fruitful relationship between coffee and capitalism could be coming to an end, as a result of all those same faults in the system. Coffee plants are quite finicky little things and only grow in very specific conditions. As of now, there are so few areas in the world suitable for its production, and climate change may soon eliminate even those as traditional growing zones become too hot. Climate scientists estimate that at least half of the acreage now producing coffee will be unable to support it by just 2050. The future after that looks even more bleak, making coffee one of the crops most immediately endangered by global warming. The irony is, of course, that climate change is being driven by unrestrained capitalism, by billions of individual free market actions adding up into pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Coffee created the conditions for the rise of those things, but in the end, if we don't make some serious changes, the consequences of all that unrestrained capitalism may destroy coffee production altogether. I certainly don't want to live in that world, and I suspect neither do you or anyone else. I'm not sure businesses could function without coffee, and here, once again, capitalism itself may provide the solution to its own woes. If anything finally kicks our collective butts into gear to do something about climate change and save our world, or at least ourselves, perhaps it will be our desire, no, our need, to keep drinking coffee. Well, my mug is empty, and the little bit I have left in the pot in the kitchen has gone cold, so I think it's about time that I go brew another pot. So I'll just say thank you again, as always, for listening. Look out for posts from me on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course on anthrochef.blog. I hope everyone out there is enduring the quarantine okay, and maybe this long diatribe about coffee and caffeine helped just a little bit. I'll see you next time.